The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is my Cyber Show.
No, it's my Cyber Show.
No, it's mycybershow.co.
On today's show, Air will be stopped in their tracks by a revolution. Agaterra will ride the tide. Kevin will explain how to escape from federal prison. The stuck funds fraud will be detailed. Hank will counter surveillance. Sean will feed CO2 to plants. And Ira will bust into the NSA. Hang on, here we go.
When my kids were growing up, at some point they asked me, "What do you want from us?" And I told them, "All I want is you should be able to read minds and predict the future." Well, they said, "That's impossible. Nobody can do that." And I said, "Well, I can. I'll show you." So I focused my attention very deeply and concentrated and said, "I predict that tomorrow the sun will come up." And then, before they could really comment on it, the next thing I said was, "Wait a minute. I'm reading your minds. You think that was stupid." So that, of course, they realized that they could read minds and predict the future as well.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Fred here. December 13th is our All.net Community Summit. We will be discussing all things cybersecurity. If you would like to attend live online remote, sign up to the mailing list at All.net. That's ALL.NET.
For details on anything you hear about at the Cyber Show, go to thecybershow.co.
Remember the old saying, to err is human. To really foul things up, it takes a computer.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news from the Cyber Show. Cybercrime earns cybercriminals $1.5 trillion every year. Illegal online markets are worth $860 billion. Trade secret and intellectual property theft, $500 billion. Data trading, $160 billion. Cybercrime as a service, $1.6 billion. And ransomware at $1 billion.
Now on to our first presenting company. Steve Holman from AIR. When we last spoke, you had built the first internet MLS, multi-listing service, grew explosively, and then collapsed.
Yes. All right.
So now, having done that once, what did you do then after that?
Oh, my gosh. Well, then I got, Red, you don't know this, but I actually became a loan officer and got involved in doing the creative financing in 2008 that crashed right on us. We were doing
So you got into another growth field with explosive growth that crashed.
I'm learning all the way, right?
So, Steve, let's just be clear. So when you're talking to potential investors, you know, the first thing out of your mouth is, "Well, we built this amazing system and it explosive growth, but then the company collapsed." And then you went into the financing industry, built this, you know, incredibly successful business, and then it crashed. Okay. And then, so now after that, what did you do?
Well, we're expecting World War III any time now, right?
Because you're starting to get successful. Let's not rush ahead. All right. So after that, after that market crash, you have another 10 years to explain to us. Go ahead.
Well, it was very interesting because now I was appointed to be on the board of directors for our local association of realtors. And we had a meeting there and we said, "Look, what's our mission here, fellas? You know, well, it's to, you know, promote our brand and, you know, the realtor brand and
ethics." Right. So Steve, you were still a real estate agent.
Oh, I've been a real estate agent all along. That's how I've been, you know, making it through this. But anyway, so we were at the association board of directors meeting and we were talking about, well, Zillow's really not our friend and we need to get some other technology out here that's going to be broker centric. So there was that. Plus they had a bunch of affiliate members who were the plumbers, electricians, mostly lenders and title people that they really weren't doing anything for. They had them on a PDF list that was already expired. And I thought, well, gosh, you fellas, why don't we put these guys together and do some business with the technology that's there? So I was like, all right. So I ended up calling my guys, my engineers, who I hadn't talked to in about 10 years. I said, "Fellas, what are you doing?" They said, "Well, we're building these mobile apps, you know." And I went, "Oh, you're doing mobile apps, are you?" So we got our team back together and we built one of the, well, again, we were building one of the first native apps for the real estate industry. And then we made some other pivots along the way as we beta tested and learned.
You see, and this is, you know, we get so used to things when they cover our lifetime, right? You know, I happen to be the same age as the Super Bowl. You know, Super Bowl is not some grand tradition any more than I am, right? You know,
I have to dispute that. Why are you not a grand tradition at this point?
Right. It's a proof of point right there. But, and I've always thought, you know, car dealerships and realtors, you know, these funny little markets that are just these arbitrary, artificial things, as we discussed in previous episodes and with AIR. You know, back in the day, not long ago, you had to physically walk down or take a horse down to the real estate agent before you could even find things. So it was a niche market. And the automotive industry, you know, let's not get into that, but established dealerships. So if you wanted to buy a car, you had to go to these people. But that's not really the way these things work. So it's not going to last forever. It's changing now. And it sounds like AIR is probably on a path.
So this whole concept that, so now, you know, he's going to go out for money, no doubt. The story goes on. He's going to go out and try and find money. And in the diligence associated with finding money, you know, anybody that's doing their diligence is going to say, okay, so you built this real estate thing and explosive growth and then crash. And then you got into this financial thing, explosive growth and then crash. So why in the world do I not believe the same thing's going to happen again?
Well, what you know is that, you know, here's somebody who can see a change coming, right? And a savvy investor understands, you know, as I said previously, right? You got to understand the nature of creative people. If you're going to be investing, if you're going to be advising, you know, you should know. So it's, in my book, it's not a mark against, you know, if they came to me the first time, I'm like, maybe they're right. You know, come to me the third time and whether you won or lost, you were right each time. So you're maybe right again, more likely.
So I think this points out a couple of things. One of them is the need for help.
Right. Right?
That is to say, likely, given the characteristics that, you know, if I'm just going to take history, they're going to fail again. So something has to be different this time. So the question is, what's different? That's thing one. But then the other question is, there must be characteristics of these people that are creating this problem. And it must be that you need to create an organization with the right set of people to be successful. And in particular, you know, I've found that engineers just don't seem to have good salespeople. And they can't find and work with good salespeople because of these self-destructive characteristics we've talked about before. And at the same time, you can't build a good company on a technology base without the technology.
Well, you've got to be risk tolerant to be creative, right? It's just, you know, by definition, you're out in the unknown space and you're poking around and you're probably going to stub a toe, right? So that means if you do that for a lifetime, you're not spending that same amount of time doing things maybe most people do with learning how not to stub your toe. So don't expect, you know, really creative people, particularly radically creative people in technology markets to have a set of characteristics that are not, you know, likely to be there.
Right. So a couple other comments. One of them is the third time's the charm. There's the way to answer that question. Well, the third time's the charm. It's yep. A saying without any particular meaning, but why not use that to convince people it could work? The other one is, well, why wouldn't I invest in the folks that succeeded against you the first time in this?
You know? Well, that's the difference between angel investor, you know, and buying stock on the market, right? You know, by the time the people who, yes, quite often beat the early, you know, the early creative folks show up, you know, they'll make the bulk of the money, but you know, you would have made more if you owned part of the little one and they actually succeeded.
Right. There's obviously risk and reward. And then sort of the other thing that comes to my mind in these contexts is the people that had their first wild guess adventure and succeeded wildly, right? They ended up being, you know, a billionaire, hundreds of millions of dollars in their, you know, early to mid 20s. These people seem to have these huge egos believing that it was all them. And throughout the rest of their lives, they do this. And you see people like Elon Musk, and I hate to bring in personalities, but you know, look, this guy, it's such a problem for everybody he's working with and has worked with over time. And you're starting to see these things come out about the way his life ran. And you look at the same thing with Microsoft and the Bill Gates and his personality issues and so forth. As you look at this, I sort of would rather go with somebody who didn't make that enormous amount the first time out, because I'm, you know, I have my big concerns about their personality and their ego. So maybe if I have enough time to talk to them and they turn out to be right and reasonable people, that's different. The other thing I encounter is people who claim successes. You get pitches where they say, I have three successful exits and blah, 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 blah. And you ask about the first question is, well, then why do you need my money? I mean, you must be a billionaire by now. And the answer is always, well, it wasn't that successful. It wasn't really that good. You know, I blew it all. on a trip to whatever. I got married 8 times, whatever the excuse is, you know, there's a lot of fluffery puffery. And so drilling in, doing the diligence on these things, I think is a really the critical part.
Well, I think, you know, what comes to mind with me on this segment is maturity. You know, if we're talking about, you know, advisors and investors and so forth, we need to come to this, as you know, my main gig these days was SIBEs, went public on the Canadian Stock Exchange this Monday before Thanksgiving. And, you know, went from 4 or 5 people to 45 people in the last year or so. I started as an advisor, been working on strategy with the team. And it's these same recurring themes, right? You know, lots of exciting things happen all the time. Founders are absolutely right. You know, it seems to be going in the right direction. And at the same time, you need to understand a lot, you know, everything we talked about in the segment, you know, understand the pieces and be able to advise or invest. And if you're investing, you're, again, supporting it. It's not just money, it's your maturity and your experience.
And presumably at this point, they're at an inflection point. This is where the next level of danger arises. They've just gone public on the Canadian Stock Exchange, but it's not like $1 billion going public. It's a much smaller public company. And so they're going to face the combination of all of the requirements associated with being a public company, regulatory and so forth, and the need for good governance, and the need to have a hierarchy in place and a management structure in place and all the documentation they didn't need when they were a teeny tiny company. And they don't have massive resources to support it, and they're in a highly competitive space, and they have a great technology opportunity.
But if you're going to take risk, you know, take them artfully and in an informed fashion, right? You know, one of the advantages of the, you know, the big advantage of the entrepreneurial person and company is small and nimble, right? You know, so as we're sort of discussing here, just you need, if you're that smart, you should be smart enough to understand the downsides and that, you know, that early success, you know, that early bit and so forth, you know, have your celebration, pop the champagne, be thinking about the downside of this before you get there. And once you get there, start acting on that. Every opportunity has another risk coming along with it.
Yes, it does.
And now a word from our sponsor. Our next A2E members forum is January 10th. Join the mailing list at a2e.co for details. That's the letter A, the number 2, the letter E.
To get in touch with companies presenting on the show, you can go to thecybershow.co and look them up.
Our next presenting company is Aga Terra. Land on the water.
One of the interesting questions I ask everybody that claims to be in the eco space, and you are in the eco space, right? You know, how have you done the calculations? What are the long-term effects? Is this really better than the alternative? So let's just talk about the alternatives to what you're doing and those sources of power and how much better or worse you are.
Well, yeah, so you look at, I mean, we're in one of these situations where we've all heard something so much that we don't see it anymore. But, you know, we compare the two in the fossil fuel energy system. I have to use energy to extract the fossil fuel from the environment wherever that is. And I have to typically refine that to some point and use more energy and then transport it to, you know, in this case, a boat somewhere. And then that boat burns that energy. And, you know, and it, you know, best with fossil fuels is typically about 35%, I think. So about 65% of it, the energy that actually is converted on the vessel is used for the purpose.
So all told, probably less than 10% of the original energy that was there is turned into useful energy in moving the boat around.
Yeah, I wouldn't claim to know the math. Maybe I've seen it, but yeah, you know, out of that 30%, given everything you have to do to get the energy to it, there can't be. I believe the majority or, you know, the vast majority.
Yeah, and then there's the side effect, the stuff that it leaves behind, right? But you also, in the life cycle, you have to account for the manufacturing and assembly process and the end of life process associated with all that stuff as well. And so let's now talk about Aga Terra's approach to this, which is, I guess, the difference is you're generating it locally. So there's none of the transportation costs. You're not extracting things from the world except energy in the form of tide, wind, sun, right? And you're converting it into electrical energy, which you use to turn motors and such. So you're still going to have motors on a gas boat. And you're still going to have most of the rest of the stuff on a gas boat. And now let's talk a little bit about electric cars, because one of the big effects of electric cars was that the complexity of the automobile went way down when you made everything electric. Is the same thing true on boats?
Well, absolutely. And it's been a fascinating, you know, couple of years, particularly this last year and a half. Last summer, I talked to a mid-40s person who was a lifelong professional sailor, you know, crewing yachts and I believe captaining, skipper, racing sailing yachts.
And even with, you know, so folks like this are really, really safety conscious. Holy cow, right? And thinking it through, you know, he was saying that, you know, it would be not just easier, but safer to have one of those vessels with, instead of one or two big diesel motors as backup when the sails aren't working, say a dozen golf cart motors. Because screw it. I mean, you'd save like 90% of the cash in the first place. Gas motors are expensive. In the middle of a storm, you could swap them out. You know, if one or two or three died, who cares?
So we'll hear more from Augatera next week as Chris describes other issues of the cyber world with respect to boats.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
This is a little segment of the show we call Cyber Cops. Cyber Cops are the police officers and other law enforcement officials who police the cyber world. And this is their story.
Kevin, I've known you for a long time, but nowhere near from the beginning of your career. So let's start out. How did your career begin?
Well, I matriculated undergraduate at the University of Washington in 1968. And then they accepted me in law school in my home state of South Dakota. I graduated there in 1975 and began my practice of law, basically.
So when you say your practice of law is something you practice but never perfect, is that right?
Well, I served as a state prosecutor, state assistant attorney general. I also served as a state law-trained magistrate and the chairman of a four-county mental health board. So I did involuntary commitments, which we're now hearing in the news, various places like, I guess, New York City.
Okay, well, there you go. So involuntary commitments, that must have been a thrilling job. So yeah. So after you did that, you were a lawyer, and then you were a prosecutor, and then you were a magistrate. So then after magistrate, how long did you do that, and what happened next? Because you're not in South Dakota now.
The magistrate gig was fairly short, less than a year. The next, and I made two trips to the attorney general's office. When I left the AG's office to establish my own practice and also serve as a magistrate, I realized that I wasn't going to be able to do both of them. So unexpectedly, I got a call from the state attorney general at home. He said, how would you like to come back to the practice here? And I said, I'd be glad to. So I went back to the attorney general's office. And I did a lot of appellate work there, basically, civil and criminal. And also, I conducted the first asset forfeiture, and probably one of the first in the United States. Certain people were carting certain kinds of illegal substances around in their cars. And so when they got caught, state decided to take the car away from them. So we also had four-engine aircraft, I don't know what kind of was, big thing, landed out in a cornfield in the middle of South Dakota. And when they came out, they found that the crew was not there, but there was 5 tons of marijuana on board. And of course, they
so the crew ran away, but you got the plane in the pot. So you took the plane, a forfeited asset, and you obviously you took the pot and destroyed it. So when you destroyed it, were you standing near it downwind, or how does that work?
Well, I wasn't, but the officers who did, that's what, when they burned it, they did. They burned it. It stood downwind. Absolutely.
So they got a side effect.
But they had to breathe, so that meant that they did inhale.
So it goes. All right. So after you finished with that gig, so what happened next? Because I know, you know, you transitioned through what, the Congress, or how did that work?
I wore out a pair of leather-soled shoes, literally looking for a job in Washington, D.C., and I ran into a judge who was with the D.C. Court of Appeals, and she knew a person in the Senate who happened to be looking for somebody who had a background in corrections law. And I guess I have to back up on the corrections thing. I also wrote the jail standards, the legal jail standards for my home state of South Dakota. So I had a fair amount of experience dealing with standards, constitutional and otherwise, dealing with the prisons. So as a result of that, I interviewed over in the Senate, and I was hired by Senator Bob Dole.
So now Bob Dole wasn't from your home state, right?
No, he didn't hire me because I was a constituent. He hired me because I had some expertise in correctional law. Senator Dole had a very large bill pending, Senate Bill 186, as I recall, and it was a $6.5 billion bill that they were going to use to build more prisons. Well, as it turned out, it cost about $6.5 billion to build one maximum security prison and run it for more like a year. So that bill didn't go anywhere, needless to say.
All right. So you started working for Senator Dole, and then what happened next?
Well, my duties as Senator Dole led me to, I was the staff attorney for Senator Dole for the first the nomination for the Supreme Court of the first female, Sandra Day O'Connor. So I was the staff attorney for Senator Dole for her nomination. And I also spent, I was on business twice at the White House with Senator Dole. Once was a bill that I worked on that created a new Circuit Court of Appeals in the United States. It was the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals.
That's the one that covers Florida right now, right?
Correct. And I also was on Senator Dole's staff for the President's Commission on Drunk Driving. Since as a magistrate, I used to sentence drunk drivers. And back in the 70s when that was, there were about 44,000 people a year killed on the highways, and half of those were alcohol related. So when I sentenced drunk drivers, first offenders, I would sentence them to 30 days, and then I suspended 28 of those days. So they spent a weekend in jail, and at least I was able to promise my community that those people that had been drunk driving weren't going to kill anybody for at least the weekend they were in jail.
Yeah, well, that's the start. So, all right. So after you finished working for Senator Dole, so at some point you moved out of that role into some other role. So how did you end up in the cyber role?
I guess I entered the cyber world, and I think it was, I'm not real precise on a date. I think it was the early 90s, very shortly after I went to work for the then Treasury Department Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, which, of course, Fred, you're familiar with since you came and taught for me and some of my programs there. Early 90s, young fellow, I can't remember his name is now, but he was an IRS agent, and he introduced me to bulletin board. And I got so interested in bulletin board.
Hang on. Before you rush forward with this, how did you end up at FLETC, Federal Law Enforcement Training Center? Did they hire you for this, or how did you get to there?
Originally, since I had a background in corrections, I went to work for the Federal Bureau of Prisons. I was a staff lawyer at the Country Club Prison up in Danbury, Connecticut. That's where, Reverend Sung Young Moon did time, and this fellow by the name of the group that broke into the Watergate. So I got hired.
Oh, yes, okay, there you go, the Watergate folks. Okay. So when you say a country club prison, is it really a country club or is it really a prison?
Pretty close, right? I mean, there was a camp there that you were considered to be an escape prisoner if you walked across a chalk line out on the, I don't know if it was a chalk line.
So the fence was a chalk line.
No, not even, you walk off. I think that's where probably Just Lane or whatever is going to be doing some of her time, as best I can tell. But it was a women's prison. The camp outside and the regular prison inside had about 600 inmates. And one day I was walking around the yard, and I have to mix with these prisoners. I couldn't, excuse myself from that duty. But I was walking around, I noticed that there was an older gentleman walking around the yard inside the prison. And he had a couple of young studs walking around behind him. And I found out that they were his bodyguards. This guy was an organized crime.
So he had bodyguards in the prison. I guess they had to commit a crime to get in the prison so they could guard him. But that was fine with that, right? It's part of the job.
Oh, that's right. But you're right.
All right. So, the Bureau of Prisons, how did you get to FLETC?
Well, how I got to FLETC was FLETC was training all the Federal Bureau of Prisons employees when they came on board. And I had gone down one summer to help fill in for one of the lawyers down at Fletcher who was teaching all of the Bureau of Prisons classes. And when he retired, I put in for the job and they accepted me. So I moved from Danbury, Connecticut, beautiful Connecticut down here to the hot, humid South. But I live in this wonderful island that you're familiar with. It's called St. Simon's Island. And I started working for the Bureau of Prisons at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center. And that lasted about a year. And then I made an application for a staff member of the regular Treasury Department, which is, there were other agencies. The Treasury was training a bunch of agencies, probably just 40 or 50 different agencies. And the reason they were training that many agencies is any agency who had agents, law enforcement agents, who carried a weapon, could make arrests or conduct investigations, they all had to be trained at FLETC. And I was in the legal division about a dozen. So I taught federal agents how to enforce the law and also how to obey it while they enforced it.
Yeah, that's one of the really interesting, important things is they have to obey it while they enforce it. And, a lot of TV shows show policemen that are rogues and one way or the other or show it. But in reality, the vast majority of police, at least certainly through my interactions with them and hopefully yours, they are taught what the law is and they're required to follow it. And they do, right?
I agree wholeheartedly, Fred.
All right. So now you're working at FLETC and at some point, something happens to turn you into the cyber side of this, but we're going to talk about that in the next segment. All right. So hang on.
So Kevin, you know, is also a professional underwater photographer, right? And as I, keep saying about this community that makes up the elders of the cybersecurity, and not just the old folks, let's not be ages about this, but it is, you know, this interesting emerging set. All these things come together. You know, like you said in that segment, you just started talking about the cybers, which the show is about, but you have to understand Kevin, right? You know, to even begin to get to say, all right, you know, how does all this come together to matter to cybersecurity? How could it not?
Well, but you know, look, his career before this, you know, when you start to drill into all these things, you know, he was involved in the first female member of the Supreme Court, right? He was involved in devising the legal constructs for putting people in prison, you know, the first asset forfeiture by law enforcement. He ends up walking, shoe leather, literally walking around D.C. to try and find a job. And the whole process by which, you know, well, Space Jam, that's right. And Bill Murray in Space Jam, and people get sucked into the cartoon world one way or the other. And Bill Murray shows up on the court and they say, how did you get here? And he said, well, you know, I called a guy that knows a guy. Brought me in. You know, Kevin is one of those people who spends his life, besides the work he does, which is fabulous, and the knowledge that he gains and possesses and works on, which is great. I mean, testifying before Congress a few times is pretty impressive. But in addition to that, he's a people person.
Totally.
When I first encountered him, you know, I thought he was name dropping.
Right.
But because he's always referencing other people for everything.
Right. In fact, I've taken a lesson in knowing Kevin about that. Right. You know, so my human network is my most valuable asset. Right. You know, I know a guy who knows a guy. Right. You know, and how do you do that? Right. And Kevin is masterful at it, frankly, because, you know, you have, and it's a great cybersecurity topic. You actually have to be trusted. You know, you, Fred, me, you know, we're old salts of security. You know, you can't, it's not easy to fool you or I at the human trust level. Kevin's not faking it. He actually is a really good person, right? That's how you maintain. And yeah, so I do the same thing. I talk a lot, and I, you know, on my shows, I want to mention the names because people deserve credit for things, but you also need to understand, you know, how all these things go together, right? And it's, you know, there's name dropping for self-promotion. You know, look how big I am. I know these people.
Yeah, but that's not what this is. This is Kevin giving credit where credit is due.
Right. Well, I'm trying to say that, right? You know, capture these two things. Give credit where credit's due and explain things. So you have to understand it's not just Bob or Mike or, you know, Angelina. It's this person with this background, this responsibility. They're the ones who are involved in my story. That matters.
It does. Also, the contextual information is always so critical. And we see this obviously in cybersecurity assessments that we do. Any sort of thing where trying to understand what reasonable and prudent things to do are, you're trying to understand it in the context of the situation. That's sort of the definition of reasonable and prudent, is that it's situation dependent, applied by somebody who has the knowledge and who has, you know, looked at the history and understands similar things. That's how you get to reasonable and prudent. And then the other thing is his background, his legal background, his law enforcement, his prison background, all of that stuff goes to his credibility and his ability to function in the cyber cop world.
Right. You know, we're in a fascinating time in information security now, right? You know, and I see there's repeating themes where things are coming together. You know, there's too much information, too much of, you know, some of the guests on the show, you know, Charles, we're digging into this as well. We're actually really good at that. We've been doing it literally forever, right? There's always been too much information, and the kind of experience that folks like Kevin have and bringing that into the cyber world where a bunch of engineers want to say, no, we want to count every individual, you know, nugget. It's like, well, that's not how any of this works, right? You know, in reality, it's about policies and legalities and everything else that are developed around sociology, right? You know, there is on the humid side of every keyboard, there's fingers. Right. You know, the technology levers are pulled by hands, you know, and how we direct those hands is legal and sociological and complex.
So there's a whole other aspect of this. And that is, lots of people sort of learn something and act like they know it. You know, there's this thing we've talked about, imposter syndrome, where you know, people that are really good never believe they're as good as they are because they always feel as if they're, you know, a bridge too far or something. But that experience is sort of fundamental to actually understanding what's going on. All the training and the education without experience won't cut it. And then the other thing about the experience is these stories are fabulous. You know, you talk about, God, so what is that kind of prison? Well, there's a chalk line. Right? So there is no wall. You know, just don't cross the line or you'll be in jail, in real jail for longer. I had no idea that a country club prison was literally, there's no wall.
talking of name dropping, Deb Radcliffe has been, you know, a longtime colleague, you know, from the Cisco and the firewall days, you know, turn of the century. She's been doing novels, you know, cybersecurity based novels. I think Richard Clark has done some of those as well, because it is, there's, you know, I have lived and enjoyed the 007 era, but the reality, while we've been watching those movies, all this is developed, right? And as we're kind of discussing here, traditionally it's always been there. I mean, intelligence gathering, human gathering, law and policy and so forth, but there's a million stories in the cyber city, right? You know, there's so much has happened over the last couple of decades. It's just a hoot.
There's a little bit more to it that I think is worth bringing up. That is, when you actually do cyber whatever, it's not just computers, it's not just networks, all this technical stuff. There's a lot of human stuff actually involved in the successful operations on one side or the other. And to ignore that is to completely fail to understand the nature of that. And I see this all the time in red teaming. People, they say, oh, I want to do a red teaming. You know, for our listeners who don't know, red teaming is where you simulate an attack on a system to try and find the vulnerabilities. And the thing about red teaming is it's pretty easy to find a way to get in. When we talk to Ira at length about that, you know, we're going to see just how simple that is, of course. But that's really not the issue when you're trying to protect things. And furthermore, it's not just a technical exercise in getting in. Almost always, the successful high-end threat is not just technical.
Right. You know, so right when everybody's done all their work to build the security system, physical or cyber, whatnot, realize if you just stand right there and don't move and just let the human system go around you, you know, Groundhog Day. You know, when Bill Murray first realizes the advantages of this, you see him watching the timing of the bank guards and just walking over, counting out loud, 3, 2, 1, turns it back, grab the bag of money, walk away. You know, it's at the end of the day, right?
We'll be telling more stories from Cyber Cops in our next show. So don't miss it. Next Wednesday, 9 a.m. Pacific time, KMBY, 1240 a.m. And on the web at thecybershow.co.
And now a word from our sponsor.
If you would like help with your cybersecurity needs, contact us at all.net using the link at thecybershow.co.
Frauds, spies, and lies, and how to defeat them. It's the name of a book, and now it's the name of a segment on our show. Now, this little bit of fraud is just the introduction to the process, of course.
Hello.
But it starts out by saying,
my name is Mr. Mark Solomon, and I work as head of competence and supervision at UBS London Regional Office.
I'm somebody in a special position of trust. Can I trust you to help me move millions of dollars?
Can you be trusted in a confidential relationship as partners and willing to be presented as a next of kin and beneficiary of...
To be presented as the next of kin and beneficiary
of an unclaimed sum of £22.3 million.
And of course, it's 22.3. The reason for the extra digit there is because it lends credibility to have a more specific amount. But they've chosen it for the fact that it gives more credibility. Now they're going to tell you that nobody's going to be harmed by what you're doing.
The funds belong to a deceased customer who died without a next of kin or trace of a known family.
Get back to me.
If you can, do get back so I can provide you with information on how to claim the funds successfully and legally in your name.
Legally in your name? Or some such thing.
Your response will be highly appreciated.
And of course, very polite at the end.
Sincere regards, Mr. Mark Solomon.
So this is a sort of a standard scam. The idea is to get you to respond. Once you've responded, they've now established that you're willing to do something that's pretty obviously illegal, of course, and that there's millions of dollars involved. And now they're going to do things like say, well, I need access to your bank account. Send me $200 for this, or I'll send you money for that if you give me access to this and so forth. And it just becomes a sequence of they're taking more and more of something from you. There are also, by the way, things of this sort where they use you as an intermediary for shipping goods or services in and out of the country or from place to place. And of course, this can be used for anything from drug smuggling to bringing explosive devices to acting as a fence for stolen goods and so forth. Now, those of you that have watched the movie called The Sting will recognize this con because it's essentially the same thing. We have some illegitimate money and we're both going to profit from it, and you and I, we're together and so forth. Obviously, if there's a lot of money involved and you're willing to, well, let's say sacrifice your morals, or maybe your morals say that it's perfectly fine to take money from the bank, then you're susceptible. If you're not susceptible, they won't get anywhere with this, but it doesn't matter to them because they send plenty of these out. They're only counting on a small statistical
meaningful number of them coming back. So my strong advice to you is don't be tempted to do immoral things. Even if you're desperate for money, you still need to control yourself in these circumstances, or you'll get ripped off in many cases for everything you have, or at least a substantial part of it. Every week we'll feature another cyber fraud to help keep you aware of what's going on and what you can do about it. If you'd like to read the book, Fraud, Spies, and Lies and How to Defeat Them, it's available online at all.net under books. That's ALL.NET, and you press on books.
If you would like help with your cybersecurity needs, contact us at ALL.NET using the link at thecybershow.co.
The Cyber Show is brought to you by Mental Telepathy. Well, actually by radio, but it's pretty much the same thing.
Now, on to our next service provider. Hank, how you doing today?
Hey, very well. How are you doing today, Fred?
I'm doing just fine. So you're our cyber lawyer, not a liar, right? So you're going to tell us the truth about it, even though it may not be always in your best interest. Last time we were talking about the fallibility of human memory and so forth. And that brings us to the subject of evidence. And so the thing about evidence is usually it's in documentary form as well. Testimony, obviously, but eyewitness testimony is notoriously unreliable. So when you get this documentary evidence, that's really the way you can differentiate, or at least a trier of fact can differentiate yes from no in terms of being truthful, even if it's not intentionally false. But let's talk then about how you get that evidence. In the digital realm, we have, you know, email and chat, all this stuff that's in digital form. But the one exception you're really not allowed to do is like recording conversations like this one without everybody knowing that you're recording it. Is that right?
You're not recording this, are you? Are you, friend?
Of course I'm recording. Give me a break here. It's a radio show.
Yes, recorded call. It's an interesting area. There's state law generally. There are federal laws that certainly can weigh on the activity also, but the general matter, you know, whether or not within a given jurisdiction a call can be recorded by one party without the other party's knowledge, or by neither party knowing, having a third party record their conversation. It varies state to state. Typically, you can't record the conversation of two other people without telling them, but there are a lot of jurisdictions where you, as one participant in a conversation, can record it without telling the other person. But, you know, then you bump into evidentiary problems. Certainly, use that call in a state that has a sort of a two-party consent rule, meaning you can't record it if both parties don't agree. You know, is that call then recorded by one person who was in a one-party state? Is that admissible in a state where both parties would have needed to agree? Maybe not.
And probably the answer is we don't know the answer until we try it, and different judges might make different decisions, right?
No, that's right. I think there's not nearly as much law as you'd like to see on the subject, meaning case law, courts deciding, you know, these sort of borderline circumstances. And a lot of the cases, you know, they say bad facts make bad law. A lot of the cases come out of unique situations where, you know, you look at the rule the court announces and wonder, is this really widely applicable? I think in life, a lot more conversations get recorded than people ever really admit to recording them.
Let's talk about recording, because telephone calls, historically, those are what these laws are about. But now we're in the digital realm and we're recording games and video calls and, you know, chats, all this other stuff. So what's the edge of this? Where does it apply and where does it not apply? And there's this concept in the law of notice, adequate notice. So generally anything is legal unless you have a notice that it's not legal. And so the question is, you know, is a chat session, is a YouTube session, or, you know, whatever it is that legally recordable or not?
And, you know, in a lot of circumstances, it would be very fact dependent, specific to the circumstance. And your guess would often be as good as mine. You know, in real world cases, Fred, you and I have had to deal with and have confronted issues regarding the utility of certain, let's say, digital information. Some things, you know, copies of files, or recordings, or sometimes text transcriptions of what's said in a conversation are automatically prepared by technologies as a matter of course.
All right. So you're saying like voice to text. Suppose if I had, for example, a voice to text on my cell phone or on another computer, and I'm listening to this conversation, it's all in the open air,
And then I use my voice to text on a separate system to text, turn the conversation into text. Then that's just, you know, completely different set of circumstances, right?
That's right. Now, I think the fact that the conversation is being made available over the air, you know, any sort of reasonable expectation of privacy has been forfeited. Now, that's a term of art that comes out of the Constitution in a somewhat different context, but it's often the language you hear, you know, thrown around in these cases. Did someone have a reasonable expectation that a communication would be maintained in privacy? That's kind of the guidepost here.
So in cybersecurity, we know that you can, you know, surveil people in all sorts of ways. In fact, you know, on one of the segments on this show, we're going to be talking about surveillance and all these sorts of things. So if you know that you can be surveilled, does that give you a reasonable expectation of privacy? Does that take it away forever for everything? And is it different to each individual what's reasonable for them to believe based on their knowledge and experience?
Yeah, it's very fact dependent. I mean, you could be talking about a workplace. You know, there's no law that per se that an employer can't put, for example, a keylogger on your individual machine at your workstation at work, your computer. Is that though? And then if after the fact they're reading logs, is that somehow a violation of your privacy if you were conducting personal correspondence on that machine? Well, maybe it depends what's in the employee handbook. Maybe it depends on what was
under. Yeah, so this is about about duties, right? If you have a duty that says it's confidential, then it is, and then you've created the expectation. And if you have an employee handbook that says you have no expectation of privacy, which, by the way, all of my handbooks and contracts say, except in the part where we say here you have an expectation of confidentiality, which is, I guess, not the same as privacy. So it's all about the context. So there's a lot more about the law that has to do with context. So can we discuss this in our next discussion?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. So as part of this discussion, because we're using Google Meet, if you go down to the bottom of the screen, you can click on the closed caption, the CC button. And when you do that, what you'll find is that it does a pretty darn good job of transcribing everything we say on both sides and differentiating what you say from what I say. And the question then is, if I turn on transcription, for example, if I'm running for Senate and I've had a stroke recently and I need to use transcription to be able to clearly understand what people are saying, when I turn that on, am I now violating some sort of a law with regard to surveillance? So, Chris, if you would turn CC on in your Google Meet and see how well this works,
we right.
can discuss it while looking at what we say.
Oh, reasonable expectations, right? You know, and one of the things that sticks with me in the early 90s, you know, on what was, what passed for social media at the time is the really, you know, emotional arguments I would get into, not emotional on my side. And I would just say, look, in the future, there's going to be cameras everywhere. And it's like, I don't want them everywhere. It's like, well, okay, given, but in the future, there's going to be cameras everywhere. And it's just this knee jerk response that, you know, not whether or not that's true, just, you know, I don't like it. So, you know, all I have to say to that is ring doorbells, right? You know, everyone's got them now already. You know, our house up in Canada, you know, in 2021, I put a tripod and a camera on the roof. You can see for miles. It was a great view. I loved having it, right? And, you know, but my neighbor has a ring doorbell pointed directly at my house. You know, so is it, you know, the reasonable expectations of privacy is the kind of thing that we're all working through individually, you know, as organizations and corporations, whether it's, you know, IP or whatever else. And, you know, as you know, nation states and as a world, you know, what is actually reasonably private? I don't know.
So this idea of recording of calls, particularly when you're doing real-time transcription, to me, I think we're getting to the point where you just don't have any expectation of privacy. And certainly if you are knowledgeable about the technology, your expectation should be lower than other people's expectation. In fact, anybody listening to our show week after week probably realizes after hearing Charles talk that they should have no expectation of privacy at all, especially if they do anything like being on the radio or...
Well, you know, I've leaned into this from the beginning. My secret squirrel handle on the, you know, what for me was the early internet was Chris Blask, all lowercase, no space. You know, it was really sneaky. Couldn't tell who I was. I expect, you know, and on a professional level, I expect anybody that's actually going to come after me, you know, to be able to figure out my name and probably my address, right? You know, what do we really want to keep secure and safe and secret? How much? And then, yes, you know, at that point, you know, again, hold my coffee. You know, we will make things as safe and secret as secure as you want, you know, to the last penny you have. right?
Well, so, you know, personally identifiable information as described in the law includes your name, your address, your phone number, your email address. Those, any two of those constitutes PII, at least as far as I recall, in the California legal framework and many other such frameworks. So one of the big problems with that is that's all trivial to get. If you say, I can't get that, or I can't have that, or I can't store that, or I have to protect it somehow, it's already public information. And once you fuse together what's already in the public, why is that something I have to protect specially?
Yeah, at an RSA conference in San Francisco, not that many years ago, you know, less than 10 years ago, I walked into a talk a friend of mine is giving on critical infrastructure. And yeah, part of the advice they gave was, you know, make sure your employees don't use social media. You know, don't have your names out there. It's like,
you have to use social media. It's required that you post a like for your company's postings.
Well, yeah, but again, the idea is that, you know, that if someone finds out your employees' names, addresses, and everything else, then you have massive security problems. You know, professionally, as I said, you know, after that talk, you know, to the speaker at the time, it's like, I assume, you know, that my clients are not going to be able to hide that information. Let's start there and keep you secure and keep you safe anyways. Let's not have unreasonable expectations of what's even possible.
Okay. Now we've been, at least I've been watching the closed caption. Have you been watching the closed caption?
I haven't, but I typically do actually. I do it so much that I'm kind of enjoying the break from it.
So one of the things that happens to me when I see the closed caption is I want to say, oh, period, at the end of sentences. Because when I'm talking, when I'm doing voice input, I have to say comma and period. And those sorts of things to end sentences. So when I see the transcription, I think I'm talking into that mode. So my mind gets all screwed up by it. But clearly, transcription's working very, very well in this context. And the transcriptions we're getting are more and more accurate. And just having this turned on as a normal course of thing, there's no notice on it, you know, to anybody or anything like that. So I think probably that era of the law has to change because it's just not realistic anymore.
Google Photos. You know, I love this now, right? You know, it's constantly popping up these year ago or similar photos. I love this one. You know, how spooky can you get? You know, it does pattern recognition on the photos that I have in Google Photos and says, hey, here's a bunch that look similar. And I could do the same by hand, but A, I'm not going to, and B, it would take a lot of time. You know, so I'm perfectly happy living with, you know, I don't care. You know, and again, you know, this throughout my career, you have to explain this. Look, you know, I will make things secure as appropriate, you know, and that can be, you know, black art, military, whatever. But, you know, you have to have a reasonable expectation for what you're trying to achieve. And any adversary that I'm concerned with, I'm assuming they can figure out where I am and probably hack my damn phone. So,
right. Being reasonable and prudent. It's a critical security function. And if your success depends on something that's unreasonable or imprudent, then
you're not going to succeed, right?
And now a word from our sponsors.
An hour after the show ends today, we will be having our all.net members forum where we discuss all things cyber. If you would like to attend, sign up to the mailing list at all.net. That's ALL.NET. Well, now on to our next company.
Our next presenting company is PowerGrow. Building eco-fantastic high-tech greenhouses.
Sean from PowerGrow, welcome back.
Thanks, Fred.
So last time we were talking about you're producing CO2 while generating energy and then consuming that CO2 in the plants so the plants grow faster. So you're producing and then consuming greenhouse gases to improve the way you grow. So how much improvement do you get in growth based on just the fact that you're producing more of the greenhouse gas? Wait, say that 10 times. So what's the improvement from the greenhouse gases that you're injecting?
Injecting CO2 into the greenhouse will increase yield at least 10 to 15%. Annually for the grower.
All right, so that's 10 or 15%. But my understanding from when we've talked about this before is you get much better benefit than just 10 or 15% out of the way you're growing things. So what's the total advantage for using a greenhouse in terms of overseeing from the ground?
You know, the real advantage is giving growers the ability to grow 365 days a year, no matter what the outside climate is like. On average, our greenhouses will produce 18 times more produce per acre than an outdoor grow.
All right, so hang on. When you say 18 times, now you're running at multiple levels, so you're using space more efficiently, right? XY space, but using more Z space, or is there something?
We don't grow vertically. It's a horizontal grow in an automated system. In our partnership with one of the growers out of Salinas, we've designed a way to double the yield per square foot in a high-tech glass greenhouse due to the design of the grow system.
So if you can tell us without giving away any trade secrets, what is that magic formula that lets you double it?
We figured out, you know, typically you plant a seed, you germinate, you propagate, you grow, you cut, and you start all over again. We figured out a way to get multiple cuts from the same seedling. And that second cut is actually a faster grow because the plant's already sprouted.
Yeah, it's already germinated. You don't have all the initial stuff. All right, so you're saving time, and that gives you a factor of two. So you can grow two vegetables in the time it would otherwise take to grow one.
Yeah, on average, a high-tech glass greenhouse will produce 600,000 to 700,000 pounds of leafy greens per year per acre under glass. And our greenhouses will do at least 1 million to 1.2 million pounds per acre.
Okay, well, that sounds like a big advantage. So that's the advantage in terms of space usage. But what are the other advantages? Water consumption?
Yep. So we'll use 90% less water than a standard outdoor grow. The carbon footprint for the plants substantially lower because you're serving a local community year-round as opposed to transporting that produce across the country.
Don't rush ahead here. Okay. Yep. You said two things. We're going to combine them together. You said you can grow regardless of the outdoor conditions.
Yep.
You can reduce travel. So what you're doing, as I seem to recall from talking to you one time before, was you're creating greenhouses near where the population lives. Yep. So there's no transportation cost to speak of, or at least it's far less. And then you're also, because you're generating it locally, you're reducing the wasted energy in transportation.
Now, as I recall, that's something like 50% of the cost of produce, right?
You're reducing the time between when you grow it and when somebody eats it. So you're going to get fresh vegetables in the winter in Alaska like this, right?
It ends up being a fresher product with far less risk of disease, as well as a longer shelf life, but typically a week longer shelf life than an outdoor grow product. So it's healthier for people, got a much smaller carbon footprint, and it's just a much better product.
Well, but when you say a better product, I mean, it's saving money and energy and efficiency and space all at the same time. So this is a win-win-win-win-win. All right, how many other wins are there in the win-win list?
Really, the only downside to a high-tech glass greenhouse is the energy intensity, as we discussed, and we're solving that with solar and fuel cells. But really, the real win is the ability to grow locally on a year-round basis, regardless of climate. I was born on a farm in South Dakota. The one thing farmers can't control is the weather. And our ability to build a completely controlled environment that has not only lighting systems and heating and cooling systems, but also dehumidification systems allows that grower to grow year-round regardless of weather conditions.
We're going to talk about the implications of that in our next segment. Okay, so now the winds are starting to pile up here.
Right. Well, you know, my earliest TV news memory, of space shots and so forth, was, you know, 4 years old in 1969, and Paul Ehrlich was with the bestseller Population Bomb, was being interviewed, and he explained that there was 3.2 billion people on Earth, and the Earth had a carrying capacity of 3.4 billion people, so 100 million Americans were going to starve to death in the 1970s. And I'm four, right? And I, you know, trying to figure out what these words and numbers mean, but it basically means that my life's going to be terrible. And we make 30% more food per person with 8 billion people than we did then.
Fewer people are starving, but the underlying cause for starvation is political.
These days, right. Food. Right. You know, but still, it's a perfect example of efficiencies. You know, we've increased efficiency of food production dramatically in the last 50 years. Still, we mostly scattered dirt. Seeds in the dirt and pray that it rains, right? Yeah, better seeds, a little better prayers, a little better rain, but the efficiencies to be gained are phenomenal. This company sounds like a good one. You know, companies in this space, I expect, if they're competent, I expect them to do well. But to be really clear, folks, this is a small step. You know, the actual efficiencies of producing food 100 years from now, 1,000 years from now, we'll look back and say, you know, in 2022, we're still basically just praying for rain.
Well, that's just not true, of course, in these greenhouses. I mean, so
right.
That is changing, right? We're no longer praying for rain. We're no longer throwing these things out there. And this isn't the only greenhouse company out there, of course, but the technology that they're putting in here is fantastic. But it's not just technology. You know, there are also people effects associated with these things. So one of the critical things, of course, is are you getting rid of or replacing all those agricultural jobs, or are you making them better, the lives of those people better? Because it's a horrible thing when you have to spend your life, you know, picking plants, you know, picking fruits and vegetables out in a field on your knees, you know, in the sun, all this stuff, it gets pretty painful. You don't live as long, you're not as healthy. And that's the opposite of what we're achieving with the rest of technology. So hopefully this technology also changes that, right?
Well, my grandma and I were really tight, and she was the youngest of nine sharecroppers' children in a panhandle Florida sharecrop in the early 1900s, when half of Americans did that. You know, from the age of about 5 years old, you're working in the field until you die at about 30, right? And now 1 or 2% of Americans work in the food production. That's generally better. right? And the working conditions aren't as awful. Like I said, we've done amazing things. We really have with food production in the last century, but hold our coffee, man. This is nothing. You know, this next step coming with companies like this, it's, you know, this is decades in the coming. You know, if you follow popular science, Scientific American, you know, whatever over the last couple of decades, you see this thing coming. Now it's commercializable. And in this decade and the next decade, it's going to advance rapidly.
I hope you're right, but let's see what happens next.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
Now, under our next service provider.
Ira, the last time we spoke, you had just gotten past the initial process of taking a test to get into the NSA. So let's talk through what are the next steps and what happened next.
Well, the next step was an on-campus interview where they basically came and said, you did really well. We're going to be on campus. Please schedule. So I spoke to a recruiter there. Then, you know, she liked me. And then I did not have a series of crimes and drug problems. And then she's like, but, you know, then they invited me to go down to Fort Meade. So they flew me down. And then I did, you know, did the on-site interviews along with polygraphs and things like that, psychological assessments and stuff. And
so what did they find out about you psychologically, or didn't they tell you?
I assume I was rated as normal. I remember one, you know, it was like a couple of weird questions. Like, you know, there was one question I remember distinctly because a lot of people answered it this way. But, you know, I was one where I see people and animals that other people usually might not see, which I thought meant I was more observant. They thought I'm, you know, the
implications. You were seeing things that weren't real.
There's things that weren't exactly there, like Harvey the Rabbit. I don't know how many people would remember that reference, but, you know, there's Harvey, you know, like, and then I go, and then I remember asking the woman, and I go, in all honesty, who would ever answer something like that? You know, and truthfully, if they actually did, and she's like, you would be surprised. So anyway.
The last four people we said yes to. Well, you're looking for people with imagination. Now you got one.
Yeah. And then what happened was I did, you know, then they basically said, okay, pretty much at the time you got the clearance, you got the job. And given that I was a liberal arts major, they pretty much said, okay, come down. We'll put you in, you know, a 6-week class, which was essentially their CY-157 class, which was, you know, different exposure to different areas. And given that, then I could interview with other, you know, with a bunch of different offices. And they're like, do you want a crypt, you know, how would you like a crypt analytic internship? I'm like, I'm not looking at ones and zeros all day. Then they said, hey, what about computers? You have really good computer aptitude. I go, I hate computers. I want nothing to do with them. That's actually true. I remember that was word for word.
That's when they said, oh, then how about computer security?
Yeah.
That sounds good. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but then my first job I thought sounded really cool. I took a job as an intelligence analyst at the National Signals Intelligence Operations Center, which was like their 24-hour nerve center.
Sure.
And God, did I hate that job. And then I thought the only thing I couldn't hate more was computers. And then I thought at least the computer people got paid more. So I was like, okay, let me reapply for the computer intern program.
All right, so just to be clear, computer people get paid more than intelligence analysts, or did at that time at the NSA.
Right. If you had the if you had the basic number of computer science and math classes. So I had to take some extra and then get, you know, I had to take some classes and then get bumped up on it. But I did that. And then, you know, and then in the greatest irony of things, after I told them I didn't want to look at ones and zeros all day and I didn't want to do computers, then my first job as an intern was working programming cryptanalytic computers. So I could say my first computer was a crate, which sounds impressive then, but means nothing else to the people listening today.
Well, no, I think there are those of us that understand that was the fastest computer in the world at the time. So we're going to take a break here because we do that. Mm-hmm. We can't run too long. So we'll come back for the next segment, okay?
Okay.
So there you go.
Yeah. Intelligence analyst at the NSA. Anybody who thinks that's an exciting job doesn't understand the NSA. Look, you know, I want to share this one. You know, I had a meeting with General Michael Hayden, who's with the Chertoff Group, but is retired. And it was right after the Michael Snowden thing. And we had a great conversation about America, right? And the NSA, right? You know, he ran the NSA at one point. And he said to me that he wouldn't say this on TV because, you know, Americans wouldn't believe him. But, you know, our allies, you know, send their security people over to be trained by the NSA and how to manage how to protect civil liberties. And, you know, you just hearing Ira talk about being an NSA analyst is a good point, right? You know, you don't have a lot of choice because there's this huge structural governance. You know, NSA analyst touches a piece of American citizens' data. There are, I think, 7 things you have to do, and they're all pedantic, filing, horrible, boring work. It's not cloak and dagger. It's just this big process, right? But anyways.
But then, because he doesn't like computers and doesn't want to look at ones and zeros, he ends up
making cruddy
computers for
cryptanalysts. Classic. You know, like I said last time, you know, the paths each of us have taken, you know, just fat, you know, and I didn't, you know, I knew Ira got to start at the NSA. You know, I'm learning things, you know, listening to this interview that I didn't know already. It really is just fascinating. You know, Richard Steenan has been writing up some of the history of the industry in some books over the last couple of years. Highly recommend them. But it's full of fascinating stories. It's just great.
If there's anything I can do to help you out in the cybersecurity arena, please get in touch via the ALL.net website. If you're starting or trying to grow a company, please visit a2e.co for free assistance and advice. Next week on the Cyber Show, look forward to Air getting back up again, Augatera floating ideas, the Cyber Cop busting out, the Legal Eagle telling it like it is, Power Grow and the Greens, Ira and the Russian intelligence agents, more fraud, spies, and lies, and who knows what else? Only here on The Cyber Show on KMBY, 1240 AM, Monterey.
A good time at Bow. A good time at Bow. A string beaten man and a fiddler for a band. A good time at Bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.